Welcome to Talk Theater in Chicago, the podcast. Brought to you by TalkTheaterInChicago.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another electrifying episode of Talk Theater in Chicago, the podcast. Brought to you by TalkTheaterInChicago.com. Coming up in today's episode, we have four good reviews from Tom Williams. We also have an excellent in-depth interview with Sherman Yellen and John Sparks of the Theater Building Chicago. They're going to be telling us about their new play, Josephine, tonight. And of course, as always, the theater news. So sit back, relax, and get ready to talk some theater. Hello, and welcome to Talk Theater in Chicago's news podcast. Brought to you by TalkTheaterInChicago.com. I'm your host, Dustin Moat. It's time for some theater news. Neil LaBute's new play, Autobahn, is set to be coming to Chicago to the Profiles Theater. Autobahn is a tantalizing cycle of short plays full of edgy humor and shocking revelations, all set in automobiles. It first received its world premiere back in January at the Studio Theater in Washington, D.C. The Profiles Theater production will be directed by the Associate Artistic Director, Daryl Cox.
Hello!
Dame Edna is coming back. That's right, the incomparable international housewife, megastar, and guru will be returning to Chicago. She will be returning with her all-new comedy extravaganza, Dame Edna, Back with a Vengeance, for 1 week only, Tuesday, March 14th through Sunday, March 19th at the Cadillac Palace Theater. Welcome back, Dame Edna. Victory Garden's new state-of-the-art theater is set to open in the fall of 2006. Chicago's Biograph Theater will be the Victory Garden Theater's home of its new $11.3 million main stage. Victory Gardens, who is Chicago's number one presenter of new work, will open its new 299-seat theater in September of 2006. The play set for the inaugural launch will be Denmark, a fact-based drama about a complex and controversial figure in African-American history. The actor John Hurd, who you may know from television's Prison Break, will be coming to Steppenwolf Theater Company's upcoming world premiere of Love Lies Bleeding by Don DeLillo. The play is produced in association with the Kennedy Center Fund for American New Plays, and after its Chicago run from April 27th to May 28th, it will transfer over to the Kennedy Center's Terrace Theater in Washington, D.C. The play is the latest on Steppenwolf's 30th anniversary season, all devoted exclusively to original work. The casting has been completed for the Goodman Theater's production of David Mamet's Romance. Star John Mahoney will be joined by Matt DeCaro, Christian Stolte, David Pasquese, Matthew Krause, John LaGuardia, and Steve Pickering. Romance is a part of the Chicago Theater's Festival of David Mamet's work, all being presented in March and April of this year. The occasion will mark John Mahoney's first appearance at the Goodman Theater in more than 15 years. Congratulations to Mary Beth Fisher, who has just gotten the role of Amanda at Court Theater's The Glass Menagerie. The play will run from March 9th to April 9th and be directed by Charles Newell, Court Theater's artistic director. Mary Beth Fisher will play Amanda Wingfield, the Southern Belle mom of the crippled Laura and restless Tom. Sean Cross will play Laura. Ned Noyes is going to be the gentleman caller, and Jay Whitaker will take on the role of Tom. Don't forget to catch Court Theater's The Glass Menagerie at its 251-seat Abelson Auditorium. A few big shows will be coming to Chicago in the future. Cheetah Rivera, A Dancer's Life, will be coming to Chicago in 2007. Chicago is one of the stops on Rivera's brief U.S. tour. Also, A Light in the Piazza is coming our way. Piazza once played at the Goodman Theater. And also Cirque du Soleil will be coming back to Chicago this summer in its old spot next to the United Center. Their latest production, Corteo, is currently in San Jose, and there have been no exact details on tickets or dates just yet. But stay tuned, we'll have them for you in the future. And congratulations to Barbara Gaines, the founder and artistic director of Chicago Shakespeare Theater. She was presented with an honorary OBE on February 10th by Sir David Manning, who is the British ambassador to the United States. An honorary OBE stands for the Officer of the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire. Congratulations, Barbara Gaines. Thank you for listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's news podcast. Remember, any information that you hear on this podcast can be found in full detail at talktheaterinchicago.com. Again, that's talktheaterinchicago.com.
Talk Theater in Chicago's Reviews Podcast, brought to you by TalkTheaterInChicago.com. This week's reviews are Blind Mouth Singing, Johnny Tremaine, Guantanamo, and A Number. Hello, this is Tom Williams, and here is my review of Johnny Tremaine at Lifeline Theater. Johnny Tremaine is an entertaining history lesson. Who says history can't be fun? Not Lifeline Theater. Company member John Hildreth has adapted the 1943 coming-of-age novel Johnny Tremaine, written by historian Esther Forbes, into a pleasant, lighthearted tale of the American Revolution set in Boston from 1773 to 1776. Johnny Tremaine is the fictional silversmith apprentice turned horse boy who helped the Sons of Liberty spy on the British during the opening salvos of the American Revolution. Lifeline Theater's original adaptations feature a multi-tiered set complete with a movable wood platform designed by Alan Donahue, with terrific lighting by John Sanchez and sound design by Adam Kozlowski that altogether created the atmosphere that suggests 18th century New England. Lindsay Pate's costumes include powdered wigs, full dresses for the women, buckled shoes and breeches for the men, with tri-cornered hats and vivid redcoat British uniforms complete with muskets. The story centers on the 15-year-old apprentice silversmith Johnny Tremaine, played with boyish charm by Geoff Button, whose future becomes shattered when an accident leaves him with a deformed hand, thus thwarting the craftsmanship necessary to become a silversmith. It's kind of hard when your right hand appears to be deformed. Johnny Tremaine becomes a delivery boy for the radical newspapers printed by members of the Sons of Liberty, led by Samuel Adams. Johnny has a secret heritage that weaves into the storyline, allowing the dynamics of the initial struggle of the American Revolution to vividly come to life. What makes this play so enjoyable is the empathetic, often humorous characterizations of early American patriots. We see the talented ensemble members, seven of which play multiple characters, one even playing a horse in a marvelous work by Shiloh Miles. They all move from one scene to another, aptly playing an assortment of characters with rich, authentic accents, nicely laced with bits of sarcasm, satire, and delicious irony as needed. This easy-to-follow piece is quickly paced with exquisite timing, effective use of lighting, sound, and staging, with minimal narration to communicate the story. Lifeline Theater's trademark productions offer a fine blueprint on how to adapt and mount a novel. If you really want to know how to do original adaptations, just get the Lifeline Theater. Both audiences and other theater people can learn a lot from this terrific group. The play recreates the Boston Tea Party, Paul Revere's ride, the Battle of Lexington, as we hear several famous quotes from the emerging patriots sprinkled throughout this polished production. I cannot believe that you could get a more entertaining view of history. It's a great show for kids, I would say, 11 or 12 on up. It's not necessarily a kid's show. It's more of a teen show, but it's a great piece of theater. Johnny Tremaine boasts a cast that supports Joff Button's excellent lead character. Yes, history can be fun, and Lifeline Theater makes it entertaining. Be sure to get there and bring your teens so that history can come alive on stage. My rating, highly recommended. It is at Lifeline Theater, 6912 North Glenwood Avenue, right off the Morris Red Line. The schedule is Fridays at 7, Saturdays at 4 and 8, Sundays at 5:30. The running time is 2 hours and 25 minutes with intermission. It runs through April 9th. You can call 773-761-4477. That's 773-761-4477. That's Johnny Tremaine. Highly recommended. Thank you. Hello, this is Tom Williams, and here is my review of Guantanamo, Honor Bound to Defend Freedom, at Timeline Theater. Guantanamo is a scathing indictment of governmental abuse of human rights. This reviewer's number one non-equity theater group proves that they mount excellent, thought-provoking theater. Their latest, Guantanamo, is a documentary-style piece written from spoken interviews, complete with photo slideshow documentation by English writers Victoria Britton and Gilliam Salvo. The show focuses on five British citizens who spent 2 to 3 years detained and imprisoned by the United States military at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, without due process of law. They were never charged with anything, and they were never given their basic human rights. This shocking indictment is told in personalized stories by actual former detainees now living in the United Kingdom. First produced in London by Tricycle Theatre and told in first-person accounts from interviews and public speeches and public records, Guantanamo is a warning against American and British governments' hysterical, incompetent, and illegal capture, interrogation, and imprisonment of Muslim Middle Eastern people without any due process of law in the name of fighting terrorism. This shocking documentary is one of the worst abuses of power and infringement of civil and personal rights. It reminds me of the internment of the Japanese that we did during World War II and Abraham Lincoln's utter disregard for the rule of law during the American Civil War. It is amazing that once threatened, governments always seem to overreact and are quick to curb personal freedoms and civil rights in the name of security and tranquility. Guantanamo coldly documents the 2 to 3 years of imprisonment suffered by five Muslim men who were scapegoats by the American and British government in a vain attempt to stop terrorism. It seems that public relations dictated that governments take action and imprison people. So this made for nice clips on the 6 o'clock news. The age-old balancing act between a society's need for security and the rights of individuals to due process of law is clearly documented with names and faces that are dramatically presented in this important, riveting piece. Imagine being in prison for years without a clue as to why or what for. That would drive me bananas. Timeline Theater's ensemble clearly outlines and documents the injustices done to the five representative detainees. The documentary-style piece was amazingly free of exaggerated propaganda and unfolded as an indictment of the incompetent and hysterical American and British military. The acting in this show was outstanding. Characters not only looked the look and had the proper accents, but you believe that we were catapulted right into a prison cell in Guantanamo. This is a marvelous piece. On the other hand, one could argue that since there were, quote, only five victims documented in the play, and that Guantanamo had over 650 detainees, that maybe it only represented a few mistakes made by governments. So the policy maybe, well, isn't too bad. Abuse of one person by government threatens all of us. They may start with Arab Muslims today and move toward other groups until we all lose our freedom. Guantanamo got me to rethink our government's policy and its war on terrorism. Rule of law, basic civil rights, and human dignity must be adhered to at all times by government. that's the best policy to ensure our ultimate security. Timeline Theater's docudrama was marvelously performed, smoothly directed to make an impact as a warning and a call to action. It is sad that not more people are concerned about the effects and threats that gross disregard of the rule of law that Guantanamo vividly outlines. Apathy about human rights is the real enemy here. Kudos to Timeline Theater for mounting this wake-up call. Let the political debate commence. I hope everyone gets to see this show. It'll get you thinking. My rating, highly recommended. The show, Guantanamo, at Timeline Theater, 615 West Wellington Avenue, Chicago, Illinois. The schedule is Thursdays and Fridays at 8, Saturdays at 4 and 8, Sundays at 2 p.m. The running time is 2 hours with intermission. Guantanamo runs through March 26. You can call for tickets, 773-281-8463. That's 773-281-8463. It is highly recommended. Make sure you get to see this show. Thank you. Hello, this is Tom Williams, and here's my review of A Number at Next Theater. A Number is a mesmerizing, provocative look at cloning. Next Theater sure lives up to its mission statement, devoted to socially provocative, artistically adventurous work, with the influential British playwright Carol Churchill's new play, A Number. This chilling work is destined to be one of the most talked about shows of the year. It is sure one of the best productions of the year. In 50 minutes of charged, mind-numbing, thought-provoking drama, Churchill tells the story of a father-son conflict ripe in 21st century biotech plausibility. What if parts of your genetic material were taken from you, and a copy or many copies of it were made leaving the world full of clones of you? How would you react? What would happen if you met several of your clones? These penetrating questions are scary. The 63-year-old father, Slater, played by John Judd at his dramatic best, is confronted by Bernard, Jay Whittaker, in a riveting, complex, icy rage. Slater's son, who discovers that he was allowed to be cloned by Slater, who didn't know he was cloned 20 times. I mean, the son realized he was cloned. He discovered that. Slater, the father, didn't realize that there were 20 copies made of him. The first son was the source, and he was left up for adoption. Why? Questions, accusations, betrayals, admissions abound as the two confront their pain and bewilderment at the life-altering information. Can you imagine if you were to find out that your father had you cloned and you didn't know why? Most people would confront the father. Filled with penetrating, pointed questions about science, ethics, morality, nature versus nurture, and the meaning of identity, this smartly written, emotionally wrenching drama will have you on the edge of your seat for the full 50 minutes. With effective lighting by Diane Fairchild on Brian Sidney Bembridge's V-shaped black box set, giving A Number a futuristic, almost spaceship look, adds to the eerie tone of the show. Told in 5 scenes, where we meet Bernard, the son, age 40, played with a growing rage by Jay Whittaker, and Bernard, another clone, son, age 35, also played by Whittaker as a sly and vengeful character. And then there is Michael Black, the son, also 35, and another clone, played with a smiley, jovial, optimistic person by Jay Whittaker. That's one of the things that I liked about this show so much was Jay Whittaker showed such tremendous range as an actor. He became 3 different characters by merely changing his tone, by changing his body language and his posture just slightly. It was an amazing performance. John Judd goes through all the stages of guilt as he plays the father, Slater. He's laced with excuses, apologies, admissions of weakness and remorse, especially as he finds out that there were many clones made. Judd demonstrates his acting talent as Slater. We listen closely to Slater's excuses and alibis. This is terrific work here by Judd also. Judd's reaction to Jay Whittaker's razor-sharp indictment as Bernard was scary, telling, and engaging. Whittaker's perfect English accent, with a slight lilt of Scottish, speaks to his classical training and his Shakespearean experience. His eloquence hammered home his rage, his rising emotional state that gave the show the tension of a mystery as we wonder how and why all this happened. Whittaker's Michael Black was so different from the two Bernards that I almost thought that another actor was playing him. Whittaker can change identities easily. He is a master craftsman of theater. Jay Whittaker and John Judd give powerful performances that deftly define the complications of cloning from a society, a family, and an individual perspective. This is tremendous theater containing intelligent ideas delivered with extraordinary skill, tightly directed and paced by B.J. Jones to exploit all of Churchill's chilling themes. Cloning needs to be earmarked for debate. And a number sure gets that debate started. The topic of cloning and its effects and the whole area of biotech is certainly going to be one of the most controversial dilemmas facing the 21st century. This show starts that dialogue. My rating, not to be missed. A number by Carol Churchill at Next Theater at the Noyes Cultural Center, 927 Noyes Street in Evanston. The schedule is Thursdays at 7:30, Fridays and Saturdays at 8, Sundays at 2 p.m. The running time is 55 minutes, and the show runs through February 26. Call 847-475-1875. That's 847-475-1875. Hello, this is Tom Williams, and here is my review of Blind Mouth Singing. Blind Mouth Singing soars as a Latino fable. Teatro Vista Theater Company, the only Latin equity theater company in the Midwest, offers a treat for theater patrons with Jorge Ignacio Cortinas' Blind Mouth Singing, now in a world premiere at Chopin Theater. This is my first visit to a Teatro Vista show, and I was mightily impressed. The stellar production qualities of the show, the fine acting, and the terrific writing all made for a fine evening of theater. From Brian Sidney Bembridge's large-scale wooden set, which aptly suggests a rural setting with a small house and a functioning well, to Misha Fiskell and Andrew Plesa's eerie sound design, together with Jesse Klung's lighting, gave the show enough atmosphere and set the mood of isolation necessary for Cortinas' fable, which I believe was set in the 1940s in a rural Cuban mountainous village. With hints of Pinter and Beckett, playwright Cortinas' engrossing story is rich in metaphor and symbolism, with sprinkles of dark humor and melancholy. This is a show that will just take you into a world that you have never seen before. It's a combination of the surreal with a distinct Latino flavor. We are swept into the rural village, somewhere probably in Cuba, where we meet Mother of the Late Afternoon, the mother of the household, played nicely by Laura Crotty. She rules her family with a strictness designed to thwart their hopes and dreams. She is definitely a much controlling figure. Her two sons, one a stupid, macho, roguish type character named Gordy, played with a lot of energy by Peter Fitzsimmons, and the other is Riderico, played by Marcus Castillo, a sensitive, gentle, caring gay boy. As each of these two siblings fight the boredom in the village, Gordy does so by torturing his sibling with a lot of physicality because he is so frustrated. In the meantime, Riderico spends a lot of time looking down into the well, talking to a figure that we hear in the well, who also sings. Lucirio, played by Marvin Edward Quijada, is a charming, devilish boy who cons Riderico into changing places with him so he can escape the well and, of course, the household. the scenes between the two are homoerotic, are funny, and amazing. I mean, how often haven't we all, you know, gazed out the window or looked at our reflection in a mirror and talked to ourselves? This is some interesting theater. The other terrific character in the show is Bolivia, played by Lisa Tejero. And she doesn't notice, neither does the mother or Gordy, when the two brothers change places. This is a nice little touch. Bolivia, the sister and the aunt to the two boys, she's yearning to escape the humdrum life of the rural community. She does so by daily walking up to the village and treating the syphilis victims in the village. She wears a veil and becomes known as the spinster from Calcutta. She earns money and a sense of independence as she yearns to leave the city and to fulfill her dreams. This is a show about dreams and making your mark in the world. The mother doesn't understand either Riderko's gentleness nor the macho frustrations that Gordy has because, you see, her husband had abandoned them years ago. So she is a lonely, bitter figure and is content with the humdrum life in the village. This show has a flavor to it that you just know. It has sort of a suspenseful feeling because you know that something's going to happen, and it certainly does. But without giving away some of the unique plot twists, I can tell you that the show sprinkles humor, desires, is filled with a fluid language and a rich symbolism that makes the show just enchanting from the beginning. Mainly because of the empathetic characters that we see, like Bolivia in a haunting performance by Lisa Tejero, and the gentle touch that Marcus Castillo gives Riderko. We enjoy, but kind of flinch when we see Peter Fitzsimmons combining his cruelty with his sexual frustration. Laura Crotty nicely gives the mother a combination of negativity and loneliness. Blind Mouth Singing is rich in atmosphere that pulls us into the rural world of the mountain village in Cuba, where the struggle for personal identity and self-worth are played out in a surreal fable that is absolutely enchanting. The play has charm, is arresting, and offers a fresh twist on the never-ending quest to define who we truly are. This is an intelligent story with empathetic characters. Jorge Ignacio Cortinas is a playwright to keep your eye on. This show is a treat. My rating, highly recommended. The show, Blind Mouth Singing, it is at Chopin Theater, which is 1543 West Division Street in Chicago. Performances are Thursday and Friday at 8, Saturday at 5 and 8:30, and Sunday at 4. The running time is 2 hours and 10 minutes with intermission, and it runs through March 5th. For tickets, call 312-494-5767. That's 312-494-5767. This is a marvelous treat. Thank you. Hello, you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. I'm Tom Williams, and our host today is Joe Stead, the theater critic and news reporter for Theater in Chicago. Since Joe Stead is an expert on Broadway musicals, I thought he'd be ideal to interview today's guests. Here's Joe Stead.
Thanks, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here on the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast. I'm very honored to be joined by two very distinguished gentlemen of the theater. I'm with John Sparks, the artistic director at Theater Building in Chicago, and Mr. Sherman Yellen, the playwright of a performance that is being done here in honor of Black History Month called Josephine Tonight. And I'd like to start the interview, if I could, with John. Let's give the listeners and people on the internet some basic background about what Theater Building in Chicago is doing. You have a wonderful series called Stages, which develops original musicals. And this production of Josephine Tonight was originally developed as part of the Stages Festival. How did this get started, and how long have you been going, John?
Oh, we've been going probably too long. Stages has just completed its 12th annual presentation in August of 2005. So this year will be the 13th annual Stages Festival in August. But the musical program at Theater Building Chicago goes all the way back to 1984. So the musical program is 22 years old. And it consists of a writer's workshop, a series of public presentations, including readings of brand new works, first time out in front of an audience on Monday nights here throughout the season, as well as the Stages Festival, which are works that are further along in the developmental pipeline, which are compressed into a weekend so people can see 8 new shows in 2 days in August, and presentations like Josephine Tonight, which is opening Monday night here, I should say February 20th, because I don't know when your listeners are going to listen to this. And it's going to run through the 26th of March. And this is a completely staged studio presentation, so it's more fully realized than the shows we present in the Stages Festival. But it's all part of a larger developmental program of new works of musical theater.
Well, and as a diehard musical theater fan, having worked as an actor and a director and a critic for many years, I'm very thrilled at what you're doing here. And it's very important that original work be developed and be cultivated in a supportive atmosphere. Obviously, Broadway these days has kind of turned into a theme park, so the possibility of seeing something like a Josephine Tonight in a New York stage is probably pretty nil, would you say?
No, I wouldn't say that at all. But every show that makes it on Broadway. Broadway has always been the tip of the iceberg for musical theater. It's always the pinnacle of success. But shows need to be built to get there. It doesn't happen overnight. We read about a lot of overnight successes, but they never happened overnight. There's a period of development that has to happen to any show. Some of the recent big successes, Hairspray, Avenue Q, they had developmental processes that they went through before they got to Broadway. Josephine Tonight is no different from those shows in that sense. We were very fortunate to be able to participate in the development of the show at an early stage, and now we're very happy to have it more fully realized in a production that's going to run here for several weeks. We have 20 or 25 performances between February 20th, the opening, and March 26th, the closing night. Can I say this now? It's going to happen here Friday and Saturday at 8 o'clock and Saturday and Sunday afternoons at 3. Opening, as I said, Monday night the 20th, but then continuing through March 26th. So lots of audiences are going to have an opportunity to see the show here. That will also help the author, in this case, gauge what the state of the material is and what might need to be done to it before its next outing, because it's never finished. There's always more work to do. And here, by the way, is Theater Building Chicago. It's the name of the institution. And in this instance, we are also the producers of this evening. And once again, 8 o'clock, Friday and Saturday, 3 o'clock, Saturday and Sunday afternoons, Theater Building Chicago, 1225 West Belmont Avenue. Call the box office, 773-327-5252.
And, of course, we have information on Theater in Chicago with all the dates and information and contact information. But since we're talking about Broadway, there is a gentleman with us who certainly knows a thing or two about the Broadway theater, having been nominated for a Tony Award for The Rothschilds in 1970. He also had the distinction of having written a script with Richard Rodgers for Rex. In fact, I have a few playbills here from these productions from Mr. Yellen's work. So we're going to do a little trip down memory lane as we discuss Josephine Tonight. But and Mr. Yellen was also contributed a piece to a naughty little thing called O Calcutta that ran for over about a dozen years or so. It's really an honor to talk to you. First of all, could we discuss a few of the productions? I would be remiss if I didn't ask, what was the experience of collaborating with Richard Rodgers for you?
Well, I met him rather late in his life. I met him before he had throat cancer. He had esophageal surgery, and he spoke through a hole in his neck. And so communication was not as easy as one would imagine. However, we became very good friends. And I remained a friend of his till the end of his life. I liked the man. Despite, you can read all these books about Richard Rodgers, and I've got to tell you, most of it is just initial.
Is
he,
it?
He was a very decent human being. At least he was to me. You know, we shared a failure. And, you know, there's that expression, I think it's a Jewish expression, that success has many fathers, and failure has none. Mm-hmm. And we didn't disown each other. We remained friends throughout it. Nobody blamed anyone for the fact that this show didn't work. And there is some gorgeous music in Rex, some of the mm-hmm. best music that Rodgers ever wrote. And so it was unfortunate. I think it was a bad idea to do a musical about Henry VIII, the man who kills several women, and have a romantic score just didn't quite mesh. But, you know, it was more something that Sondheim might have rejoiced in. But anyway, as far as Richard Rodgers goes, it was an honor for me to know him.
And Rex was, I believe, the second show that he wrote before he died. It must have, was he as much of a perfectionist as we read, or was that a little exaggerated from your point of view?
Well, he was a human being, like all of us. He tried to do the best he could do with the talents he had. He was fortunate, because his talents were amazing. And they flowed. I mean, I got to tell you, the melodies were there until the very end. Sometimes the projects were ill-fated, but man, he was just a master of melody. It just came, it flowed from him. I mean, a better person to discuss that with would be Sheldon Harnick, who was his lyricist. Mm-hmm. I was the humble book writer.
And on that topic, you know, they say that no matter what the problem with the show is, it's always the playwright's fault, isn't it? If they blame the book, no matter what.
Always the book writer, invariably the book writer. And in fact, I remember there was an interview about Richard Rodgers' life, and it was on PBS, and Sir Andrew Lloyd Webber gave an interview, and he mentioned Rex, and he said, "Well, I never saw the show. I know there's some beautiful songs in it, but I hear the book was terrible." So I have a play on off-Broadway now, and it's called December Fools. And it's about the widow of a famous composer. And one of her lines is about cats.
Ah.
And she says, "Why put it in a theater when all it needed was a litter box?" And it was my small way of getting back at someone who was making a comment about something he had not seen. No, I think, you know, the subject of Rex, it's history, and it had an ill-fated, in many ways, it was a difficult show to work on because we had a star who was a very difficult man.
And that star was Nicole Williamson.
Yes, and I do not, you know, I don't want to malign the man. He did the best job he could, but it was extremely hard working with him. And it was not an experience that, only my experience. It was an experience that many people have had who have worked with him. Great temperament and a great artist, but not easy.
Mm. Let's talk a little bit about the construction of a musical. There's the old line, what came first, the music or the lyrics, the contract, of course. But what generally is your process in creating a work of musical theater? Where do you start? Where is the inspiration that comes from? Maybe you want to talk a little bit from the point of view of Josephine Tonight, which we'd like to promote here.
Yeah. Well, I worked with the late Wally Harper, and we had done one show before, which was done in regional theaters called This Fair World, which was done at Stages as well, because it allowed us, we put it on, it was the Berkshire Theater Festival, and I was never happy with the way it worked, and then we did revisions, and we put it on at Stages, and I think it was charm. It was one of the, you know, it was a terrific show, because Wally and I both wanted to revive the notion of musical comedy, of doing a real musical comedy, not a spoof, but something with romantic ballads and funny scenes and a point of view. I think we ultimately succeeded in doing that at Stages. Didn't think it worked so well before we had gotten to that point of revising it. So we had done that, and then Wally said, "Well, what are we going to do next?" And I thought, one of the problems of the musical, of writing a musical, is having characters who naturally sing. You know, there's something pretty silly about getting up there on stage and singing one's heart out. Then the notion came to me, well, it would be nice to do one with a show business background, where the people who are singing are singers, where it flows very naturally. And we started examining various people who we might want and I did not want someone whose music was so iconic. For example, I had previously worked on a Jolson project called, what was it, Broadway Man. And one of the problems with that is that Will Holt, who did a brilliant score for it, but it was always competing with Tootsie, that kind of thing. So you have that problem if you're dealing with one of these iconic figures who's associated with certain music. And the fact is, with the exception of Les Deux Amours and a few Josephine Baker songs, most people today don't really recall anything about her except the bananas, the skirt of bananas and the grass skirt. And I also had read, you know, several biographies of her, And there had always been projects about doing a Josephine Baker show. And none of them ever came to fruition. And I started to think about that. Why? Well, she had a messy life. And they tried to cover too much. And the thing that interested me about Josephine Baker was her early years. And nobody had ever explored that. How did she become Josephine Baker? How did a girl who had virtually no education, who grew up in East St. Louis, one of the most segregated places in America, who had no help, how did she create herself? How do you become a 14-year-old kid who's dancing in the streets, imitating chickens for pennies, and goes into black vaudeville, and then goes to Harlem, and then becomes an icon of the jazz age? She was her own Henry Higgins. She was a woman who was capable of making changes within herself. And I loved that, and I also loved her social conscience. The fact that even though she had the narcissism that every really first-rate artist has, at the same time, she had a broader view of the world, and that she wanted more than just for herself. And so I decided we'll take her from 14 in the streets of East St. Louis and end when she's 19 years old. She's arrived in Paris, and she has suddenly become the star. And it also allowed us to use a musical vocabulary that, if we had just stayed with the Paris thing, would have gotten a little repetitive. We have ragtime, we have blues, we have gospel, we have an enormous range of music, of African-American music. And while he was a master of, you know, he had been Barbara Cook's accompanist for many years, he knew more about popular music and the history of such music than anyone that I ever worked with or ever knew. And this is not pastiche. This stuff comes from the soul. This is, I can only speak of my late partner reverently, because he was such a great composer. And sadly, not known as that, known as an arranger. I mean, Tommy Tune wouldn't do a show without him. Mm-hmm. And of course, he recreated Barbara Cook. But this was, at the end of his life, what he wanted to do for himself. And writing these two musicals were really the culmination of that. And he loved this show. He adored it. He had the best time in the world writing it.
And since we're talking about Wally Harper, the composer of Josephine Tonight, obviously it's a bit of a bittersweet experience since he did pass away last year, but what a wonderful thing to be able to honor his talent by producing one of his last pieces. And Wally is very well known for his work with Barbara Cook, but many people will be surprised to discover his work here as a composer. He was a vocal arranger, a dance arranger. How did you begin working with Wally?
Well, I had a small grant from the National Alliance for Musical Theaters. I mean, a stipend. It was a tip more than anything else. But it allowed me an opportunity to decide to become a lyricist. I decided, too many years I had worked on books. And every time the big moment came, I had to hand it over to the lyricist. And I said, well, you know, I think I can do this. And I'd worked with masterful lyricists, and I'm not competitive with them, people like Sheldon Harnick. But I decided, you know, it's time I try it on my own. So I asked friends about who's a great composer who is not that well known. And a couple of friends of mine produced recordings of some of the music that Wally had written. He wrote a song for Irene called The World Is More Than an Avenue.
Did he write that?
Yeah.
I love that song.
Yeah. And I heard that, and I said, that is a true show tune. That is a great show tune. And this man is not known as that. So Wally, I called him up, and being Wally Harper, he didn't answer the call, so I started looking for other people. Then about a week later, I get a call from him. Can I come over today? And I said, sure. And so he came to my apartment, and he met me, and he met my wife, and we looked at him. And we had never seen anyone in the world who looked like Wally Harper. Wally was rail thin. He looked like a cross between Fred Astaire and Goofy. And, slick black, blonde hair. And my wife, who is a designer, she collects Art Deco artifacts. She said, that is the most Art Deco face I have ever seen in my life. And with the cigarette hanging down from it and the martini. I mean, he was a creature from another era.
A real character, huh?
More than a real character. And so I said to him, I'm thinking about, doing a show. I have this notion about doing a show about the World's Fair of 1939-40 in New York. And I think it's a wonderful background for a show. And he liked it. And I said, does it appeal to you? Yes. And I said, well, do you think you'd like to work with me? He said, well, we're going to have a great success. I said, how can you be so sure of that? And he said to me, well, to make a great musical, it takes a homosexual like me, Wally Harper, and a Jew like you. And you got to mix them together, and that's what you get. You get a great musical. So I said to him, well, I said, Wally, I'm not much of a Jew. And he turned to me and he said, but I'm one hell of a homosexual. So
oh, that's wonderful.
That was Wally. It's typical of Wally. John will tell you stories when we were working here. I mean, I can't even on, well, Wally was a very bawdy character. He was uncensored. He lived an uncensored life, unfiltered. He smoked Camels without filters and lived a life without filters and lived it to the hilt and enjoyed it. And everybody, well, somebody once asked me, what was most true, would you say, about Wally? Well, there were several things. He was an intensely loyal man. You couldn't trust him with a secret, but you could trust him with your life. Another thing, I just think he made you feel 20 years younger and 10 pounds lighter in his company because he had that rare thing, great charm, as well as enormous talent. The pity of it is that most people did not hear Wally Harper play the piano without a great singer singing with him. But the first thing you notice is that here's a man playing the piano and you are listening to a full orchestra. He was just a great pianist, incredible, John. I've spoken enough. Let Mr. Sparks talk about it. But unless we want to talk about the origins of Josephine.
Absolutely. If you don't mind my asking, how is a nice Jewish guy suddenly writing a piece about a French chanteuse, African-American for Black History Month? How does this work out?
Well, I don't believe that anybody owns anything. Anybody wants to write a play about a Jew, you're welcome to write it. And mostly, I think Josephine Baker, of all people, believed that we have to get beyond these boundaries. I mean, she adopted children of all races. She lived a life trying to break down those very barriers. I think she would be delighted with the mix of people that we have in this show. We have an African-American choreographer, Gordon McClure. He's brilliant. We have people on the staff. It's a mixture of every faith, religion, color. It's that kind of project, and I think she would have approved it. I don't think she would have liked to feel there was an exclusivity to what she did with her life. She was gone for much broader territory. Also, she was fun. I mean, if the show is anything, yeah, we touch upon the problems, social problems of growing up in Jim Crow America. However, it's a lot of fun. It's a very funny show. I must say that as the book writer, because I've only talked about the lyricist.
And you're certainly entitled, I want to turn the microphone back to John for a moment, to talk about how this project has been in the gestation. It developed, it premiered here at Stages and Theater Building Chicago in 2002, I believe. And then Wally and Sherman also wrote another piece that was produced here the following year. So where does this fit into the scheme of the programming here? What has the process been like, and what are your goals here with this production?
The primary goal is to help the show find its audience, find its place in the world. So our program is purely developmental, and it starts at the earliest versions of most shows being read for an audience for the first time through the studio presentation of Josephine Tonight, which is more fully realized, takes more of our resources, and has a longer run. The primary purpose of that part of the program is to introduce it both to audiences and potential producers. So it has a chance to escape, if you will, the developmental world and get into the more commercial world of theater. I see this as a service to the industry because it is so expensive to produce a musical today. The more developmental experiences, and I need to say the more nurturing developmental experiences that a show has, the better. It's important that a show be presented to multiple audiences and probably in the hands of multiple collaborators. And by collaborators, I don't mean writers. I mean directors, music directors, actors, etc. Because that gives the authors a chance to understand how it really ticks, what makes it really work, what functions, what doesn't function. So by the time they get into a big bucks production, the risk is lessened. It's never going to go away completely. But if you try to go from your computer to a commercial production in one step, the risk is enormous. And you can be talking millions of dollars at risk on a single performance sometimes.
What is the role of the actors, and how important is their contribution in a production, which is it's kind of a showcase production for the work?
Well, actors, of course, are essential. I mean, you can't present a piece of theater without actors. And the contribution is sometimes extraordinary. Especially, speaking as a writer now, I would say I learn a lot more from actors than I learn from dramaturgs. And I'm a dramaturg myself. But I know that dramaturgy comes from an academic point of view. Actors need to embrace characters, and they need to justify everything their character does and says during the production of any show, be it a musical or a play without music. And so the kinds of questions that actors have really help focus an author's opinion. And when an author watches an actor struggle with a scene or even a single line of dialogue, that helps them to understand what's wrong with it and how to fix it and how to make it better. I'm not sure what the difference between, for instance, using in our case with Josephine Tonight is a non-equity cast. But when we first did it in the Stages Festival, we had
Lilias White,
and as a director, we had Tazewell Thompson. We had some very accomplished people working on the show here with Sherman and Wally. And it was very exciting to see what they brought to it. However, I have to say that watching the actors that have been in rehearsal here for the last 5 weeks, it's equally exciting to see what the actors bring to it and how that does change the way the show can function, at least on our stage in our theater. In another production, it might be very, very different. You always get something from the actors that you can't get without them.
Of course, having a star like Lilias White, who's had major Broadway credits, is going to be very different than having a non-equity person.
This is interesting, because it was a concern of mine, because at Stages, Lilias is an amazing performer. She's one of the great artists of our time. And I always believed in the material, but it wasn't until I saw Monique Whittington, who is takes the same role, who is a non-equity performer, but a brilliant performer, that I knew the show works. Because it wasn't Lilias White just being great up there. It was because the material was good. Oh, boy. Ego. But the reality is that this is a show, basically it's about the relationship between Josephine Baker and her mother, Carrie. And her mother is a surprise in it. Her mother then, in front of the audience, becomes her mentor, a woman named Big Bertha Smith from African-American vaudeville. And she plays two roles. So it's a great star vehicle. And, of course, Josephine is just a young girl who we track throughout. But I would say that if there's any deception, it's as much Carrie Tonight and Bertha Tonight as it is Josephine Tonight, because it's about the connection. How do you become the person you are? What are the values you've gotten, and who has given them to you? Most of the big numbers in it really belong to Carrie, the mother, and to Bertha.
Let me say one thing about stars and working with stars, because there are stars and there are stars. When Lilias was here, it was no surprise to me to find out how wonderful the material was, because as wonderful a performer as Lilias is, if the material isn't there, all she can do is belt it out. And maybe the voice can excite an audience, but it can't make an audience laugh. It can't move an audience to tears. The thing that's going to move the audience is the writing and the performer's ability to take the writing and inform it with life so that the audience can participate in it. And that happened. And it happened again and again and again for Lilias. And in rehearsal here, I see it happening again and again and again for Monique. And Monique is a wonderful actress and a wonderful singer, and she's able to do this so well because the material is really carefully crafted and has been honed, and it has been changed even in rehearsal here. Nothing has been left to chance. Every time we see something that we think could be a little bit better, it happens. I just wish we had, more resources and more time, and we could do even more. But we're doing what we can do here, and we're very proud of it. We're very excited by it. But I don't think it's any different working with stars. And over the last 5 or 6 years, we've had what I term a sort of celebrity event in the Stages Festival. There's usually always one. When we did the Jolson Broadway Man by Will Holt and Sherman, we had Sam Harris in the role of Al Jolson. Well, there isn't a bigger personality in the world to put on one of these little stages than Sam Harris. And yet working with Sam, he was, you know, quintessentially professional person. He couldn't rehearse enough. I mean, if anything, he wanted to rehearse more than the other actors could really handle. He just wouldn't stop. And
if I can interject, right now you have Savion Glover performing in the original work here.
Savion and they're doing what is essentially a kind of cabaret with language and music and rhythm. And of course, Savion is supplying the rhythm. They don't have a drummer. They have Savion. They don't need a drummer. And it's a fascinating and interesting use of those three talents. It's unique. It's like no other show you've ever seen.
Except Josephine tonight.
Well, Josephine is also like no other show you've ever seen. But I guess what I'm trying to say is that most stars are stars because of what they can do and because of the professionalism they bring to doing that. It's the insecure people who don't always behave well because they're afraid that they're not going to be seen at their best advantage. But people like Lilias White, who will come to Chicago and spend a week here and work hard and do two performances, that's not egocentric. And the same with Sam Harris, and the same with Karen Mason when she came to do the show about Dorothy Parker for us. It was an opportunity to do something that they couldn't do under other circumstances at that time. And one would hope, I mean, I would certainly like to see Josephine tonight in a more commercial production, and I'd love to see someone the stature of Lilias be able to really show off that role in that kind of a production. We'd have loved to have had her here for our production, but we're totally satisfied with the actors we've got. Chicago has a terrific acting pool. We're very fortunate.
It sure does. And how many productions would you say in your history, John, have actually gone on to fully develop productions or even more regional work beyond Theater Building Chicago?
Many. We've had one show that was done in Stages 2000 or 2001. I'm a little hazy on what year. That the very next season was a main stage production at the North Shore Music Theater in Beverly, Massachusetts, because the producer was here, saw it in Stages, and went and talked to the authors and put the deal.
Was that Abyssinia?
No, this was I Sent a Letter to My Love by Jeff Sweet and Melissa Manchester. In fact, this, virtually the same cast that was here. Pat Birch was the director. Cass Morgan played the leading role. The point is, it got a main stage production, and now costumes, orchestrations, all those things exist, and that gives the show a big leg up for a regional life. Another show in 1998 or 99, Jungle Man by Bert Nevaire and Rob Muir, was produced handsomely at Stage One in Wichita. I went to see it there a couple of years ago, and there was terrific interest in an off-Broadway production. Unfortunately, it went in on hold when Disney announced they were going to do a stage version of their Tarzan. Mm-hmm. And Disney had trademarked very cleverly the word Tarzan, so the authors of Jungle Man couldn't use the word Tarzan in the script, let alone in the title. But then they thought they would call it Jane's Jungle Love, and Disney's lawyer said, oh, Jungle and Jane says Tarzan, you better be careful. And I know Burton's lawyer said, look, you might be able to win that argument, but they have a whole building full of lawyers, and you have me, so what do you want to do about that? So they got rid of Jane in the title, and it just became Jungle Man. But it went on and had a life in a rather impressive regional theater. Some have had Broadway productions, some successful and some not successful.
But the point is, of the purpose of the festival and of a lot of the work that you do here at Theater Building Chicago is to move the production on and to give it a life beyond Chicago.
But I just like to say that John and the people at Theater Building, and stages particularly, they're doing something which the Disneys of the world are not doing. They are really developing new musicals. They're not taking tried and true properties, old movies, although from time to time someone will develop something out of an old film. But they are people who are willing to take risks. We are living in a world where musical theater is no longer about taking risks. It's about being as comfortable. It's about doing Pajama Game with a star. And there's nothing wrong with that. But if there are no new musicals coming up as a result of the doing Pajama Game with a star, then something is seriously wrong. At least there's something seriously wrong with Broadway, at least as I perceive it. But
I think that's so well said, and that's why I felt that this was a very important story to cover. And why we really appreciate the work of stages and Theater Building Chicago. Let me ask you, because I know that our time is limited on the podcast, but Sherman, getting back to the craft of what you do as a playwright and a lyricist in this case, I think Terrence McNally once talked about constructing the book of a musical. And he said he pretty much wrote it out as a play and then expected the lyricist to take parts of it and to be able to cut it here and to feed off of that book. Is that kind of how you approached it with Wally? Or you're in this case, you're your own lyricist, but do you have that sense of ownership over a piece that, no, I wrote that, leave it alone?
Unfortunately, I'm an old pro. So it means that I have to know how to kill my babies, the things that I love the most. I mean, I have thrown out, and I hate to say it, some of the best lines in Joseph Eve Tonight are no longer there because they cannot support the number of musical numbers we have. I have added, since Wally's death, 3 new songs. Now, they are songs, with one exception, we have John Steinhagen, who's our musical director, who did the melody for this and the rhythm. In the main, I've used Wally's music that is in the show and used it as a kind of prequel. Sometimes, because we found there was a hole. I had to fill it. And there was a moment that had to be, I mean, I remember we've done about 3 songs, three or maybe even 4. One called, the one I did with John was Too Young, Too Black, Too Thin, because it was about how the world perceived her when she first went to try to get a job in Broadway. And it's and then there are others, an argument between her and her husband, Eddie, because she refuses to be rejected in a restaurant, and he's willing to go along with it. He's, you know, he says, you know, it'll be better tomorrow, and she says, I want tomorrow now. And and there were so many things in looking at the material again, coming here, and Wally was gone, and I felt, look, we're going to make this the best show, and it's still Wally's music. Mm-hmm. So as far as the structure of a musical, I don't believe in rules. I know that there's a guy out in California who will teach you for $400 how to write a screenplay, and who has never sold one. And there are all kinds of people like that who say there are laws. There are no laws. I mean, there are certain things about construction, about developing character, about trying to tell a story with humor and charm, if you can do it. But I don't subscribe to any rules. I don't think it's a book. Experience is one of the things. You know, look at people. And one of the things you need is an audience. I'm going to tell you, if there's one problem is that shows cannot be developed in a vacuum. The audience is your partner as well. I mean, we have not had an audience for this here. We've had it at stages. It'll be very interesting in the next couple of days to see how that audience connects with us and whether we've done our job right. I hope we have.
Sherman, you are the recipient of several Emmy Awards as well. I'm interested to know, writing for television these days with so much reality TV out there, is television still a viable medium for a writer, or is it kind of a thing of the past?
Well, without dating myself, I came in. My first script, I wrote it when I was 20, and it was the golden age of television. Well, they called it that, whatever that means. It means a lot of people sitting on porches, rocking back and forth, and doing a lot of regional dialogue written by people who had never left the Bronx. But I couldn't write for television today. I haven't written for television in 10 years. I've done some screenplays. I did a couple for Warner Brothers that didn't quite take off. I don't know how you do it. It's a business. It's always been a business, you know, but it had pretensions to being an art form early on. There were shows like Studio One, like Playhouse 90, with drama, actual drama, not series. I mean, the best, look, I'm a Law and Order fan. You know, I've got to admit, there's some things I do like on television. I don't know that I could write for them because I like to develop my own characters. I mean, one of my pleasures and one of my problems is that I like to cook from scratch. I don't like other people's ingredients.
Well, I'm sure excited to be seeing what you come up with Josephine tonight. We'll be here for the opening night on Monday, and the show will be running through
March 26th, Friday and Saturday at 8, Saturday and Sunday afternoon at 3.
Producers, welcome.
So I'd like to turn the microphone back to my my colleague, Tom Williams. And Tom, do you have some questions for Sherman or John?
I do have a couple of questions. Thank you, Joe. I think you've done a great job. A couple of things. Is the show audience-friendly?
Is it ready for an audience?
Oh, definitely. It's very audience-friendly. It's more than ready for an audience. It's the question is, what's the audience going to tell us about the show? We need to know that. That's why it's ready.
Are you satisfied with it, Sherman?
Oh, I am more than satisfied. I think that we have what we have on stage. Look, like anything at this stage, it's uneven at times. Sometimes it just lights up the world, and other times it's not quite there yet. But I think it lights up the world more often than dims the stage.
Okay, and you had said that it's the music in it is all original. It's not the traditional songs that Josephine Baker did.
No. Well, there's one or two songs that are in the style of Josephine Baker, but not. In the main, we're dealing with another part of her life, the ragtime part, the part of America in 1919 to 1924.
Oh, that's a great era to deal with. I'm looking forward to the show. You know, we're all going to be there reviewing it on Monday the 20th. When does the first preview start?
Previews begin actually Saturday night. We have a couple of run-throughs, open rehearsals on Friday and Saturday afternoon, but Saturday night and Sunday afternoon are the actual preview audiences, and then you get at it.
Well, then we get at it on the 20th. Well, great. I'm looking forward to it because I think it's a great topic that needs to be done, and I really appreciate you guys taking the time to be on the podcast. And, Joe, great job. You're a pro as usual, and we're very well prepared. Well, folks, that's the end of this podcast, and I just want to remind you that Talk Theater in Chicago will have the reviews of all the shows, and it'll have news articles with Joe Stead. And the only thing I want to say is I'm Tom Williams. Thank you for listening, and go see a play this week.
Thank you for joining us on this electrifying episode of TalkTheaterInChicago.com. Brought to you by TalkTheaterInChicago.com. Join us every Monday for some fabulous reviews, some in-depth interviews, and as always, the theater news. I'm Dustin Moat, reminding you to go out and see a play this week.